All right, everybody. Welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. I am Ben Popper, director of content here, joined as I often am by my colleague and collaborator, Ryan Donovan, editor of our blog, maestro of our newsletter. Ryan, you are an aficionado, not just of the data warehouse, but the data lakehouse.
I mean, it's the new hotness.
Yeah. If you don't have a private jet and a data lakehouse, you're doing it wrong. So today, we're lucky to have Nick Hudecker, who is the Senior Director of Market Strategy and Competitive Intelligence over at Cribble, a longtime analyst in the world of data and analytics over at Gartner, on the program to chat with us about the state of data. We're going to be talking data lakehouses. We're going to talk to vector databases and their role in the new world of Gen AI. And yeah, just sort of getting Nick's take on the market with over a decade of experience looking at this. Plus, he'll get the chance to talk his book a little, tell us what Cribble is up to, things of that nature. So Nick, welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So for folks who are listening, just give us, you know, real quick, what was your path into the world of software and technology? And then how did you end up focusing on data? I know you worked yourself as a platform architect and an engineering manager in the world of mobile for a while, and then transitioned to the research side and then began to focus, I guess, more on data and analytics?
Yeah, it was a long path. Honestly, it started during a Navy enlistment. I was a cryptologist, and that's when I really got my first taste into Solaris and Unix, and I was able to parlay that into a job working as a contractor at Ford Motor Company. And that took me, oddly enough, more places around the world than my Navy enlistment did. Finished that job and then ended up joining a bunch of startups. Learned Java programming really well. I feel much better now, though, now that I'm not doing it. Long path. And then eventually I ended up at Gartner, where I was an analyst covering data management. So I've always kind of had like a data and analytics bend, always been interested in the data side of the equation. And now, I've been at Cribble for 3.5 years. I left Gartner in October of 2020, joined Cribble in November of 2020. And it's just been a rocket ship. The company has grown. We were fewer than 50 people when I started. Now we're nearly 700. So it has been very rapid growth.
Well, it's nice to have a data expert on. We've been talking a lot about generative AI lately. And generative AI,
how could you not, right?
I mean, so is everybody, right? And it uses a lot of data. And the data, that the way it's packaged is sort of shifted, right? So can you talk about what that data landscape looks like now, especially in regards to generative AI?
Well, I think there's some new stuff out there, right? Vector databases have certainly made a splash on the scene. But then I think what you're seeing is like what you always see when requirements change, right? Or desires change. You saw this a long time ago with things like XML databases. I remember in 1999, 2000, there was this kind of surge of XML databases, which turned into a $0 billion market because the incumbent vendors added that capability to their own database products. You've already seen, like in, I think, March of last year, IBM has added vector database capabilities to DB2. Oracle announced it in September. So while there's always like this kind of new splash of new products and companies out there to meet this, let's say, very specific need. Like in the case of Gen AI, you see a lot of use of vector databases. The incumbents very quickly add those capabilities. We saw them do it with XML databases, object-oriented databases. That kind of went away. And then you saw it with JSON, right? MongoDB, right? Hard to argue the success that company has had. Very popular product. But a number of companies immediately added those capabilities to their incumbent platforms. So databases, it's easy to kind of like point at new technologies and new methods and just assume that it is game, set, match for everything that came before. But that's rarely the case. There's always room for incumbents to continue to innovate. But from the data landscape perspective, certainly vector databases, we see object storage, right? That's incredibly popular, especially with Cribble customers. Certainly data lakehouses. You know, I know you mentioned you're an aficionado of those. I see them as basically kind of low rent data warehouses and also data warehouses, right? All of these companies offering these products are adding the capabilities necessary to do Gen AI. And that's important because Well, that's where a lot of the data is. And that's what really makes a difference with Gen AI. It's not the algorithms. Right. It's really the data.
I was listening to an NVIDIA presentation yesterday talking about the AI landscape. And a word that came up a number of times was exabytes, which, you know, kind of puts the fear into you when you're thinking about where you're going to be working and storing data. I guess another interesting component of this that I'd like your take on, as you mentioned, right, like, will incumbents just come to match this versus, you know, what can startups do? It does seem like there are folks, for example, Pinecone, you know, who specialize in vector databases and have been growing quite quickly. Do you think that there's some differentiation in what they're offering or just their specialization and their ability to make a name for themselves?
I think that there's always going to be a few companies that hang on, right? Like there was a bunch of JSON databases. I'm sorry to keep using that example, but it's the most kind of time recent. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be some of these companies that survive. Pinecone could potentially be one. You know, they'll get some stickiness in the enterprise. They'll develop a community around their product and they'll hang on. But I still think there's a lot of room for the incumbents, right? One, they've got a lot of money, right? A lot of these companies are, you know, flowing cash like crazy every quarter. And that gives them a significant war chest either to build their own capabilities or buy some of these companies as well, if there's a reason to do so.
So, you know, speaking of money, like the data storage and exfiltration isn't always free, right? So if people are going to, you know, exabytes worth of data, are there changes in how these offerings are priced and how people are trying to get around paying tons of money for the exabytes of storage?
I think we're going to have to see new technologies for storage if we're talking about exabytes. I did a project right before I left Gartner around DNA-based data storage, and you can store a tremendous amount of data right now at very high cost, but you can still store a tremendous amount of data in a cubic milliliter of water, or not water, but like DNA material. And it's incredibly resilient. And you can introduce enzymes into those environments and then process that data there without really burning a lot of electricity. So if you want to start talking about exabytes of data, you need to start thinking about maybe Microsoft's Project Glass or DNA-based options just to make this feasible at any level. I mean, there's a need to store a tremendous amount of data, but you've got to have the storage media available. And so a lot of companies, if you start talking about exabytes of data, you could very quickly be priced out. Can you physically buy enough storage to keep all that data? Mm-hmm. Can you rack and stack those drives? I mean, there's just a lot of logistical issues and like laws of physics you have to think about. You know, the money aside, like, is it even physically possible for more than a handful of companies in the world to have that amount of storage on hand?
Right.
Remains to be seen. You know, not everybody's CERN, right?
Right. Yeah. And also, obviously, we're talking about generative AI here. We imagine a world 1 or 2 years in the future where it's pretty common to have a product where I enter text and it produces high quality video. And then I wanted to save that video for me, you know, now every day I'm ginning up all of this extra data that I want somebody to hold in the cloud for me somewhere. You know, maybe I'll pay for the storage or whatever it may be.
And not just storage, but also network, right? Like you got to move all that video around too. Some companies have solved this problem. I think Google's done a good job of it, but that becomes another challenge.
Yeah.
Right. So I think another of the challenges is securing the data, right? People have very valuable data, even in terms of, you know, the logging data. I've heard of, you know, logging data getting exfiltrated and people hacking systems because of that. How are people securing these large, large warehouses of data?
I think it's piecemeal right now because they're dealing with just so much. Companies have become accustomed to securing their business data, right? Because it's tied to a business process. So it's like, okay, I understand what started this data collection process. I understand where that data is going and the workflow that got it there. So it's a lot easier for companies to think about, all right, my business data, I know how to secure and govern that at least 80, 90% of the time. But log data is coming in from all kinds of different sources, endpoints, servers, applications, containers, and, you know, a dozen other different sources in a lot of different formats. some developer could roll out an update to an application, and all of a sudden you're going from info logs to debug logs, and you've got clear text passwords in there. And so I think it's piecemeal at best. This is a frequent use case that we see at Cribble, where all the data passes through our observability pipeline product, and we're able to go through and say, all right, you know, here's PII data, let's mask that. And by having that one point of control between your sources and destinations, we can greatly advance that conversation. Most enterprises today, though, are not there, and they're struggling, I think. And it's also because it's not directly tied to a business process. It's kind of like the exhaust of business processes. A lot of companies don't even know what they've got or don't have. So it's difficult for them to know what to secure and how to secure it.
Yeah. I just wonder if, you know, is there a sort of computational cost to, you know, if you decide to encrypt everything, all your data at rest, does that add sort of blockers overhead to your computation?
I don't have an experience there. I imagine that, you know, the kind of the obvious layman's answer is yes, there's certainly going to be overhead there, not just in data processing, but also things like metadata management and how do you understand the data quality. Right? Is that data accurate? Does it reflect a real world scenario? If it's all encrypted, it becomes very difficult to figure that out, right? Is this data even viable for a Gen AI use case? Every layer of protection you put in creates an additional layer of complexity when you try and get it out. Mm-hmm. And where do you find that? Where do you find that balance?
Right.
I'm not sure this is an area you know about, but I just wanted to ask, you know, when you have proprietary data within a company and, you know, you're interested in leveraging it, you know, in the Gen AI space, is there a new kind of ETL pipeline, a way of looking at data quality, you know, whether that's accuracy, freshness, relevance, or a process, you know, for doing that lift and shift and maybe some human annotation that you think, you know, folks are beginning to understand best practices and glom onto some of them as they work on this?
I think companies are starting from a much lower level of maturity than that question kind of gives them credit for, right? I mean, like they're still working on the basics of data quality. And honestly, nobody gets out of bed like excited to go make sure they have high quality data, right? It's janitorial work at best, and no one wants to be responsible for it. So they're starting from a very low sense of maturity. So they have a long way to go. You mentioned lift and shift. So are there new ETL pipelines that are coming out to do this? I'm not seeing anything particularly compelling. There's some startups out there that are just getting started, trying to figure out, you know, product market fit, what their go-to-market might look like when they eventually find that and so on. So it's very early days for these kind of AI ETL pipelines. But I think companies need to, they need to really deal with the blocking and tackling of classic data management. Right? Data quality, metadata management, perhaps master data management, all of the things that we have been talking about for over a decade are still things that companies need to do. If you want to be successful with Gen AI, start with the basics, honestly, right? Catalog your data. Where does it come from? Who accesses it and why? How frequently does it get accessed? Apply the classic measures of data quality, completeness, consistency, validity, you know, all that stuff. Also ensure that it's also has a high level of business data quality as well. Instead of just the technical aspects of data quality, does this data reflect the business world that I live in? And that's always changing, right? If your business isn't always changing, if your data is not always growing, you're basically going out of business. You know, I'm pretty confident in saying that. So it's not something you can just kind of like fire and forget. You need constant care and feeding of all of those disciplines. I don't know if that really answers your question, but you know, it's kind of a curmudgeon-like response. But frankly, that's just what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Are there new measures of data quality that come about because of Gen AI? And are there ways to sort of distinctly say, this is good data? Can you universally say that this is good data?
I think it's been a forcing function for people to look at, like, if I'm going to train this data to make decisions or generate content, will it accurately respond to real world scenarios? And so this has been a forcing function for companies to kind of, you know, does my data reflect the real world? Mm-hmm. You know, am I training these models to act in a real world. And I think that's something that, you know, maybe not new measures, but a refined focus on these data aspects.
Right. I mean, I do think there's an interesting question there, which is, what is the purpose of a Gen AI versus a search engine? Mm-hmm. A search engine's job, we want to bring the world's knowledge to you and help you find, you know, accurate and trustworthy sources. In a Gen AI, you know, often what they're saying is, we want to help you create. We want to help you as a collaborator, as a thought starter, as a synthesizer of information. They have to then play politics and, you know, worry about bias in a way that's very different from search. And, you know, overcorrecting for that maybe lead to as many headaches as undercorrecting for that, right?
Yeah.
But it is interesting, right, to think about the open acknowledgement, which I think kind of kickstarted all of this, which was, no big company wanted to be the first one to dip their toe in this. It took OpenAI to say, here's this thing. It makes lots of mistakes. Hope you have fun with it. And then everyone said, wow, this thing, you know, this thing is great. And then everybody else, you know, had to kind of play catch up. And so Ryan and I have been looking at a lot of different systems, and they are evolving. You know, retrieval augmented generation is a super interesting one in the context of what you do, right? Like, that's all about taking a subset of data, organizing in a certain way, thinking about, you know, embeddings in vector databases to avoid hallucinations, to, you know, make a Gen AI that's meant to be a knowledge chatbot more efficient in certain ways. And now we're getting these systems that have multiple kinds of AI. They have a Gen AI, but then they also have like a planner, or they have a critic, or they have a fact checker, you know, kind of built into them. And so I guess, right, the question of like accuracy, you know, to your point, we're not mature enough even in knowing like what the final use case of, like, there's not a lot of fully fleshed out business use cases. You know, Klarna said they replaced their first line of call centers with AI. Well, as far as I knew, most of those people were robots anyway. Like, my experience with customer service is, if most of the time I'm talking to a robot and a dial by number thing anyway, right? Like, I don't find that.
You know, and I read Klarna's press release on that, and it was basically a case study in the book, How to Lie with Statistics, right? Oh. Like, they really shaped that data. So it's like, okay, I'm going to make this look as positively as possible to reflect the benefits of AI. And I found a lot of that to be highly suspect.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're preparing, maybe hoping to get into their IPO window, and they wanted to put some good stuff out in the market.
You know, look, there's a lot of AI washing out there. Mm-hmm. And I think there's always a presumption towards maturity. Mm-hmm. And this stuff has not been out that long, right? It's not the seventh inning. You know, we're still in warmups right now. The pitcher's on the mound. You know, we haven't even had the national anthem sung yet. It is still incredibly early, right? There's going to be a lot of regulation that comes out about what you can and can't do, data sources that you can and can't use. I'm sure the European Union is going to have some opinions, followed by regulations about what data you can use from European customers and how that might vary. So we're really just getting started. It's far too early to pick winners or even identify what viable use cases might be. You know, you mentioned OpenAI coming out saying, you know, hey, this thing is not perfect. We have a mantra within Cribble. If you're not embarrassed by your first version, you shipped too late,
right?
Like, you got to get it out there. You got to see what's going to happen, how people use it, and then adapt from there.
Yeah. No test like reality, right?
Right.
Nick, I saw you had something up, and it was mentioning, you know, where you work and some of the, you know, stats around Cribble and its growth. And just, you know, you mentioned this at the beginning of the episode, you know, how quickly it's been growing. So can you tell me sort of like where it fits into, you know, the space of other companies that are playing around in the world of data and observability? Like, what's the differentiator, you know, if someone were to come to you from a Snowflake or a Datadog or a Splunk or a wherever?
So initially, the company's vision was to make that observability data better. Our initial product was Cribble Stream, which is an observability pipeline. We didn't come up with that term. A guy named Tyler Treat did. He's got a great blog post on it. And basically what that does is it sits between the sources of observability data, the things that are emitting logs, events, metrics, and traces. And it acts as a universal collector and receiver for all of that information, allowing you to route it to multiple destinations, enrich it in flight, filter out data that maybe, you know, you might want to redact or eliminate. getting rid of white space, for instance, is incredibly valuable. You can also transform data. Like if you're familiar with Windows Classic Events, they're a nightmare to deal with, right? They're incredibly bulky. If you can convert that into a more economical format, you can save a lot of money downstream. And you can also, once again, reduce that data. If you've had things that maybe events that you don't need or things that you want to suppress or sample, there's a lot of different ways you can manage that data as it goes on to its destination. That was where we started, right? Cribble Stream is our flagship product. We've since been expanding our product portfolio quite a bit. We're now calling Cribble the data engine for IT and security. So when you think about Cribble, I want you to think about us in the same breath you might think about Snowflake or Databricks, but for a very specific audience. Mm-hmm. And it's that IT and security audience that's always been underserved for its data needs. So we've expanded Cribble Stream to also include Cribble Edge, which is our unified agent to do data collection and routing directly from the endpoint. Good level of manageability for fleets and subfleets there. We've also included Cribble Search. And you know, to your earlier point, like, you know, some of this data or a lot of this data has to be centralized in one place. Well, when you're talking about petabytes or maybe even exabytes of data, you're not moving that.
Right.
Like that's staying where it is. What Cribble Search does is it allows you to leave that data where it is and then search it in a federated way. Mm. So if you've got data in 1,000 S3 buckets and you've got data in Splunk and you've got data in Snowflake, we can search all of those. Now, this is not SQL because IT and security audiences do not know SQL. Not NoSQL, but they do not know it as a first-class kind of language to interact with data. They know search, right? They grew up with Elastic, Splunk, PromQL, et cetera. So with one search interface, they can search against all of these different data sources, including Cribble Edge, and get their results back. And the last product that we've recently introduced, currently in beta, will be GA soon, is Cribble Lake. And this is a way to, out of the box, organize your data for whatever use cases you may have downstream, share it with other parties, and so on. So I think of this as a way to compose your own data infrastructure for all of this observability data that you're dealing with, right? You can put the pieces together that you need, send data where it needs to be delivered to. And in the context of Gen AI, we see a number of companies that use us to cleanse and refine data and label it before it goes into, you know, AI ops-based systems, for instance, that are probably some of the earliest AI companies out there in the enterprise.
Yeah, I mean, since you're in the observability space, and we talked about logging a little bit earlier, do you think the move towards the sort of richer observability monitoring is a good thing, or does it have drawbacks?
I think it's a good thing, and I think it has drawbacks. You know, well, like any hyped term, right? Like the difference between, you know, the promises and the ROI are very different. And I will say this, you cannot buy observability, but it won't stop people from trying to sell it to you. And so I think there's been a lot of kind of like religious style arguments of, you know, oh, if you need observability, you just need traces and you don't need metrics and logs and events and so on. And another company or party may say, no, you don't need traces, you need logs and you need, et cetera. You have to decide for you what you need. Mm-hmm. And often different groups within the same company need different sets or subsets of that data. So as long as you don't get caught up in the dogma of what observability is quote unquote supposed to be, it can provide massive value. But I think it's been a long time coming. You know, I talk to economic buyers for solutions, and they often don't understand what they're going to get out of an observability solution they're not already getting out of a monitoring solution. So it's really incumbent on the buyer to understand what that potential ROI is going to look like. And, you know, keep your hand on your wallet, right? Because, you know, a lot of these investments may not pay off for you, but it is also important to experiment and see what may work over time. This is actually one of the advantages that we see is, you know, by sitting with one of our core products, with Cribble Stream sitting between sources and destinations, companies can kick the tires on a lot of different products without having to commit to them, right? Because we can take existing data sources, route them to a new platform in the right format, and make that testing very low cost. So having that flexibility, keeping your options open is super useful.
So as we wrap up here, I have to assume former Navy man working in cryptography quite a long time ago, and then spent some time thinking about the value of data and compute. You're holding a big bag of crypto, right? I mean, you were early. No, I'm just teasing.
Nope. Hey, and oh, by the way, it was not that long ago. Actually, it was. I'm just offended you said that. no, not a crypto fan. I will admit that.
A cryptographer, but not a crypto fan.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Also not You're a crypto among friends.
Yeah. So maybe I've got some inside knowledge that everybody else should take advantage of. But yeah, not a crypto fan.
Okay. Yeah. Good to know. All right, y'all. We are going to give a shout out to someone who came on Stack Overflow and spread a little knowledge or contributed some curiosity. How can I fix value error? Expect a 2D array, got a 1D array instead. Oh no, you don't want a 1D array in your scikit. This be Shiva, got a lifeboat badge yesterday for giving a great answer and has helped, let's see, over 90,000 people. So we appreciate it, Shiva, and congrats on your badge. As always, I am Ben Popper. You can find me in 2D on X. You can email us with questions or suggestions. podcast@stackoverflow.com. And if you like the show, leave us a rating and a review.
I'm Ryan Donovan. I edit the blog here at Stack Overflow. You can find it at stackoverflow.blog. And if you want to reach out to me on X, you can find me at R4 Donovan.
Nick Hudecker. I'm the Senior Director of Market Strategy and Competitive Intelligence at Cribble. If you want to find me, tell me my opinions are wrong or right, hopefully right. You can find me on Twitter/X at nhudecker. And if you can figure out how to spell my last name, that's part of the challenge. And if you'd like to know more about Cribble, go to cribble.io or join the Slack community at cribble.io/community. There's about 7,000 folks there happy to answer your questions.
Sweet. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you soon.